You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. It's been a while since we delved into the world of ufology, so today, author and investigator Paul Stonehill joins me to discuss his new book, Russia's USO Secrets, Unidentified Submersible Objects in Russian and International Waters. Paul has been writing about UFOs and USOs from his home country of Russia for several years, and this book focuses on encounters around the world by both Russian ships and submarines. We discuss the mysterious sounds of the Kavaki, strange sightings in the Atlantic, unusual encounters above the Arctic Circle, and the individuals who sought to bring the truth to the Russian public. It's a subject we still don't know too much about, especially as Putin begins to close many channels that were reopened back in the 1990s. A big thank you to Paul for joining me, and keep listening after the interview for an introduction to one of the Soviet Union's most notable UFO investigators, the decorated Air Force Colonel Marina Popovich. A big thank you to Paul for joining me. Don't forget, you can support the show by signing up to our Mysteries and Monsters Patreon for bonus content and early releases of the regular show. We're on all social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and you can also subscribe to our channel via YouTube. Artwork for the show, as always, by Dean Bestel. The show was produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Now, let's investigate some strange encounters above and below the seas with Paul Stonehill. Today, we take a look at a subject that has always intrigued me since the mid-1990s, and that is unidentified submersible objects. Joining me is an author and investigator I have wanted to speak to for quite a while, Paul Stonehill. Paul, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for inviting.
You are very welcome. Now, Paul, your latest book, recently released on Flying Disc Press, is covering Russia's USO secrets. Now, this is a subject that has often intrigued me, as I said in the introduction. Was this a natural progression? Because you've done several books about ufology and cases from the Soviet Union. So, did you feel that this was the next step for you in regards to your releases?
Myself and my co-author, Philip Mantel, we thought we collected so much materials, and I've been doing it for so many years. It's a separate paranormal phenomenon, so to say, and it deserves to be spotlighted, let's put it that way.
Yes. I mean, is it something that you've always, because obviously throughout your career in, as an author, Paul, you've released, as I've touched on there, numerous books. Is it something that's always been there when you've been uncovering these cases from the Soviet Union?
Especially this information started coming out in the late 1980s when Gorbachev introduced his policies. All of a sudden, all pent-up energy for the release of information from people who had done actual observations, it burst out. And while even the Soviet Union was in existence, publications appeared, and Navy personnel started telling stories with exact details, locations, and so forth. And then we also found out, as the time went by, about the secret Soviet naval program to study USOs and UFOs, because one and the other are quite often interchangeable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I found very intriguing reading your book was that there are obviously several individuals, Paul, that have obviously, even before the fall of what we called the Soviet Union under Gorbachev and the openness that allowed a more cordial series of relationships to develop towards the end of the 1980s and into the 90s. It's very interesting to notice there seem to be a few individuals throughout the 60s and 70s and 80s who were very much involved in the collation of these cases and trying to improve both the recording and also getting this information out. Did you find that surprising based on the way that certain people had been treated under the previous regimes?
No, because this is how we lived. We had this totalitarian system over us, and lies, disinformation, and almost total control. But it was almost total, because people found ways to get information, to express themselves. We had underground groups, political and otherwise. We had underground ufology groups. We had people who stood above underground and wanted to study, but they got punished for it, like Vladimir Azhaja. He passed away last year, but he did so much for ufology and especially USO research in my country. He was suffering because of his outspokenness, because of the Communist Party shutting him down and losing jobs. So he went over to his naval friends. He was from the Navy himself, submariner. And they gave him the best of the jobs. They gave him the chance to study USOs and the effect on the Soviet Navy, and put forth his ideas, and he got paid for it. So this is the dilemma we had in the Soviet Union. People always trying to tear apart secrecy any way possible. And it worked. We had great ufologists. We had Felix Ziegel, for example, scientist, astronomer, who was leading UFO research, and others around him. And we had people who were actually used by the Soviet Setka program. This, and I explain it in detail in my book, the top secret research program. So they had to invite even unofficial ufologists to help them. We had quite interesting cases. Back in 1967, there was a case unprecedented and unequaled in any other country when military people, ufologists, and scientists joined hands and appealed to the Soviet population from Central TV in Moscow to send in information about unexplained anomalous phenomena. Nobody called it UFOs. They were not allowed to. But this is what happened. You can't see it in the United States, in that scientists and ufologists and military people would ask general population to send in reports about unusual things they see in the sky. So that's the Soviet Union for you. Maybe that's why it collapsed after all, because you cannot live with a lie. All this, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it is very interesting, as you touch on, Azhaja especially. I found that very interesting that he was able to kind of survive the Politburo's attempts to completely discredit him by getting into the Russian Navy, Paul. So for somebody like me, was that quite normal, where different aspects and different arms of the Soviet regime would look after their own? Because I would imagine for most people without a real knowledge of Soviet procedures would presume that, you know, Azhaja would basically be person non grata normally. Yet here he seems to have been protected by a separate arm of the Soviet machine.
Yeah, he had very good connections, and he himself had served in the submarine forces. If the Soviet Union wanted to make somebody non grata, like they did to some dissidents or Solzhenitsyn or Sakharov, they would do it. He was interested had certain interest to the government, and that's why at the end they allowed the Navy to use him, because they were also put aside all this political nonsense and so forth they were feeding us. The government in the USSR was as confused and scared about UFOs and USOs as any other government in the world, and they wanted answers. To us, general population, they were feeding lies about this being bourgeois invention or American tries to cross our border, this and that. Mm. They were scared because they couldn't control. There was a case in 1973 when over the one of the top secret facilities, scientific facilities in Dubna, a giant UFO appeared and was hovering right over the center that was producing some of the most advanced Soviet weaponry and science research, and scientists were running around and you know, trying to call Moscow, and Moscow, I mean Kremlin, said, "Well, don't worry, we are in control." But they knew that that nobody was in control. See, a zhuzha was necessary, especially with this aspect of you. USOs. What happened is that the Soviet Navy was expanding itself in the 1960s, and there was all of a sudden they started meeting unusual objects down below, which circled around them, which would come close to their submarines, moved at incredible velocity through the water, you know, oceans, seas and lakes. And the Soviets were basically going crazy because they thought, what is this, a new American invention on NATO? And what are we going to do? I'm a submarine commander. And all of a sudden something comes to my ship and a gigantic object and starts making noises. And I am very close to the United States. What do I do? And there is no way. Moscow is not, they don't know anything. So Soviets became very, very interested in what's going on, and they created special teams of high-level military professionals, bright engineers, military scientists, and they sent them all over wherever Soviet Navy operated to collect information, to study, to try to get samples. And the Navy was foremost in all this research. Later, in 1978, they finally created an all-union program to study UFOs and USOs, but they used the Navy experience. So a zhuzha was in the right place at the right time. And I've placed in the book, and you know, reports of Soviet Navy personnel who were actually involved in this program. It was like a giant, in a way, this program, Sietka, it was like a giant vacuum cleaner trying to get information from anywhere they could. But I want to let you, you know, listeners know too that they had two specialized centers of information analysis, one near Moscow, one near Leningrad. They functioned well. They received the best. You can only imagine what the military can find and process. And they received the best of this information. And most of it, we don't even know where it is today. We collected, Philip and myself, as much as we could, and we are proud of it. But trust me, it's the tip of the iceberg. And we don't know where iceberg is sailing right now.
Yes, I think it's very interesting, that part you touched on there, Paul, because the section on the book that talks about these mysterious encounters with the submarines, I think there's something about being on a submarine and having a mysterious encounter that raises the stakes somewhat. I think, you know, if you're out at sea on a boat, for me, I think there's that fear of being underwater anyway, enclosed in a submarine, Paul. But to then begin to encounter strange things, and I believe the term is they call them kvakaris, which is a Russian, based on a Russian word for croaking, because that was very similar to the sounds they were experiencing. And once again, you had people experiencing things who were being told, "Oh, these are just USA sonar recon missions, and it's nothing to worry about." But once again, these people and submariners were saying, well, they can't be, because they're super fast, they're super maneuverable, these are not man-made objects.
Absolutely. First of all, we list different types of submarines and different approach on different times of there are strategic submarines, there are multi mission submarines and all that, but all of them encountered quackery, and they had different experiences and different conclusions. But at the end, when the program was mysteriously shut down, we don't believe it was shut down. We just believe it went a little bit more upwards and more became more secretive. submariners were not we're not sure what they were meeting, and they knew they couldn't get answers from the center. The center did not know anything. But as you will see in the book, it's not only the Soviet center, Navy command center, that did not know about quackery. Apparently, this was something that their Western counterparts also knew about, and you've never heard about it anywhere in the West. But we are glad that because of Gorbachev's policies, all this information came out. It wasn't supposed to. I don't think, governments in the United States, United Kingdom, and so forth wanted this information to come out. I'm 100% sure they all work together and have been doing it for many years at the very highest levels. But you couldn't shut it down because a historical, basically, event took place and an empire crumbled. And when empires crumble, dust comes out.
Yes.
And that's why we were able to get out stuck.
I think it is very interesting because that clearly has some parallels with the Foo Fighter phenomenon from the Second World War, Paul, because all sides thought it was the other. Yet again, it seems that when it comes to Kavakari, neither side thought it was anything but the or that was the official explanation. It was basically blaming each other when clearly it wasn't.
It was not. And Kvakery, I'm sure they didn't go anywhere. It's just a different level of research. But you ask me about people. I want to bring up Pavel Popovich.
Yes.
The Soviet cosmonaut, from the first detachment of cosmonauts. He was very instrumental. He and his wife, I met her many years ago in Los Angeles, and I'm very, very glad about it, very proud, because she was a tremendously active lady in the field of research for ufology, Marina Popovich. But Pavel Popovich, who was also from Ukraine, which is also pride to us, but he knew so much more than he revealed even after the fall of the Soviet Union. This was a very unusual personality. This was somebody who had helped ufologists of the USSR, those like Azhaja, who were not very careful sometimes and needed protection from the top levels of the government, from the KGB and others. It was he who helped ufologists. It was Popovich who himself had observed UFO over Cuba, I also believe in 1978, and Popovich who brought up a lot of information. Even during the Soviet times, he spoke to newspapers, and he kept saying that we cannot keep this information under lid all this time. We have to understand that things are happening. I'm being simplistic, but that's about what he said. And here are the cases that I know about, and he brought it forward. See, in his position, he wasn't afraid. There was no way why would they arrest him? He's not doing anything against the government. He is one of the top Soviet cosmonauts. He was involved in the special missions against the Americans in space. During his career, and he was completely loyal to the Soviet Union, but he wanted to know. And in the book, we have portions of his interview. I think it was about 14 years ago that he gave this interview and so forth, about his knowledge shared by other cosmonauts about ancient visitations to our planet by advanced extraterrestrial civilizations. And he also talked about underwater bases in our ocean, specifically in the Indian Ocean. And I think your listeners will find very, very interesting what he had to say. Because here was a person, again, who was very knowledgeable. Again, I don't see American anything equivalent in the United States. I don't see astronauts speaking to newspapers and sharing all the knowledge they have. Some have tried, and they have been jeered and debunked or whatever, but we're used to it. But see, the Soviet Union, it was a very complicated society in many ways. And like I wanted to know ever since I was you can say a child, because I spoke to somebody who had been flying over the Arctic Ocean and had seen something unusual, and they were shooting at it. This was back in 1930s. Plus, I collected all available information in the Soviet Union about paranormal phenomena, or we didn't call it that. We would call it anomalous phenomena. Mm. But we were able to, and I present examples in the book. For example, there was, still is, a magazine called Technika Молодежи. It was a very freedom-seeking magazine. Let's put it that way. And they suffered for it, but they published reports by cosmonauts, by Navy personnel on their pages about unusual objects that they had observed in the sky, in the waters, on land. And of course, they had to publish government opinions, differing opinions. But because of this, we learned a lot. And, you know, there were people who talked. They talked on lectures. I present examples of, for example, submarine commanders discussing procedures and techniques, how to use, below the surface, what to do. And they would veer off. They would start speaking about unusual, gigantic objects passing them at incredible speed or surfacing. You couldn't put it down. They all know about it. The problem was that if you reported, sometimes they would make fun of you. Hmm. Until that SETCA program came about, but nobody ever knew what is the standing with UFOs, because the government promoted American debunkers. They published their books in the Soviet Union without any problems. The government was trying to say, well, UFOs do not exist. They were scared because, first of all, unauthorized observers would see results of Soviet military testing in the space. And that happened. But at the same time, they observed UFOs, and the Soviets were afraid. First of all, what we're dealing with, and secondly, well, the Americans, if they start snooping around, which they did, and they find out about these unauthorized observations, they will know what we're doing. Mm. But at the same time, what is this gigantic object trying to reach our borders, our sacred borders, are being invaded by an object we cannot stop, even if we put down, deep water bombs and so forth.
Yeah, I think that's the problem for both regimes, both the Americans and the Russians, throughout the Cold War, Paul, is essentially they are both indoctrinating their population to believe that their system is the best and they are unstoppable in a variety of situations. And yet both were going through a very similar process of disinformation and belittling anybody that was coming forward. Because my theory on this is very similar to that, is that essentially you had the two most powerful military organizations on Earth who essentially were being invaded by something that they couldn't understand and they couldn't stop.
No, they couldn't stop. And I think at the very top levels, they exchange information. I've seen too many examples of this and joint programs as well. And they could not. In the United States, we had a very good example of Congressman Gerald Ford. I really liked him. I remember a little bit about him. He wanted to bring forth information about the 1966, I believe it was, the wave of UFOs all over the United States. And he was pushing U.S. Air Force to reveal information very much. And he couldn't do anything. And when he became a president for a short time, he did not reveal anything too. So, on the other hand, you have the Soviet Union, for example. You had a very powerful, very mysterious man, Yuri Andropov, who was, all his life he was active in the Communist Party apparatus, and then finally he became the head of the KGB. Very intelligent person. Every day on his desk, there was a file with updated UFO information and USO. I think it was him who was instrumental in pushing forward creation of the SETCA program, because it wasn't just created because Brezhnev said, let it be. No, you had to go through, dancing steps, so to say.
Yes.
It was created by the Military Industrial Commission. This was the name of it. Of the Soviet Union, they had to allocate funds. And, you know, because we lived in this different Kafkaesque society in the Soviet Union, I remember, I have all the history of the Setka creation. I remember the problems they had to go through, jump through the hoops to get a living quarters or office, to get an office in Moscow to study this, because there was not enough offices. And you had to go through bureaucracy, even to study ancient civilizations or extraterrestrial presence on Earth, you still have to go through bureaucracy.
Yeah.
So, you know, but nevertheless, I want to say that I have great respect for the Russian Navy. My family served aboard Soviet vessels too many years ago, and these are they're courageous people. They had suffered also a lot, you know, several wars and so forth, yet they had very keen observers. And they brought forward information, which you'll find in the books, about cases, details all over the world, from the Bermuda Triangle to the Dragon's Triangle, you know, from the Arctic areas, which are very interesting. And I urge your listeners to pay attention to the Arctic, because things are developing there. Even China, whom we should never forget, ubiquitous China, is getting involved in it, because there is something in the Arctic outside of natural resources that is beckoning all of them, including I've included in that book a tremendous amount of cases confirmed and by the Setka program and the newspapers and others, because newspapers would receive reports from local population about UFO research, and definitely several years bring attention. Like 1979, there was a wave of UFOs all of a sudden all over the Arctic, unusual objects. I've never heard descriptions of UFOs and USOs. But also, let's remember, this was not that long ago, 40 years ago, but in the folklore and tales of the Yakut people, you have descriptions of the iron fish in the cold waters of the Arctic. And you know, and that territory is not so well researched, even up until today, explored. And I point out to the Taimyr Peninsula, to the Yakutia, very interesting land, gigantic piece of Russian Asia. And also, I'd like your listeners to pay their attention to the Kuril Islands. You know, it's I know Japan wants to get them back, as they say, and they think it belongs to them. But it's not only because of national sovereignty. Things are happening in the Kuril Islands, and a few years ago, I came out with the story of what's going on now on the Matua Island in the Kuril chain. It's a completely closed off territory now. It's all under complete control of the Russian armed forces and scientists, because they found a few interesting things. But in the book, we present cases from the cold waters of the Okhotsk Sea and Tatarsky Strait and other areas, which are not that far away from China and Japan and the Dragon's Triangle and the unusual things you see there. And then you have Kamchatka, Chukotka, all those exotic sounding territories, part of the Russian Federation. Very few people speak about them because they were heavily militarized and off limits to the foreigners, just like Norilsk in is today. You can't really you can, but it takes a lot of, you know, efforts to get there. What I want to say is that all this time there were capable military observers who wanted to bring information. Even the KGB files in 1991, 124 pages of the KGB files were given to Pavel Popovich by the head of the KGB at the time, general, not head, but one of the generals, Sham. And I know Philip Mantle had a very interesting conversations with the Russian journalist who took an interview, and I translated it from this person, Sham. But besides that, this information made its way out and I've studied many times those 124 pages, and you see cases from the Russian north, from Novaya Zemlya down to Central Asia too. And I compared with the cases I've collected through the years through my channels in the Soviet Union. I was active and involved with the UFO organizations, several, before the collapse, during the collapse, and after the collapse.
Yeah.
But then the situation changed in early 1990s, and you still could get information out. But in 1994, it kind of went, it stopped.
Yeah.
Yes, you can get information. It takes a lot of efforts, a lot of research, but it's all different today.
Yeah. I mean, looking at the book, Paul, there are several areas. I mean, like you mentioned there, the Russian Arctic coastline was obviously an area of defensive significance under the Soviet Union, and it's a vast expanse of coastline as well, isn't it? So I believe that obviously over the last few years, Putin has begun to sort of rearm and restabilize the area. And it doesn't surprise me that if you've got and numerous amounts of military installations dotted along this coastline and doing a variety of scientific and military experiments. Once again, as we've seen paralleled in American and British and Canadian military installations, it seems that these attract the attention of unwanted visitors.
I think the unwanted visitors were active in the Arctic long before. If we look at the Yakut legends, or if we look at reports from even 1950s from the Arctic pilot Akuratov, who, by the way, he was one of the people who made sure that in 1967 there was this manifestation of ufologists on Soviet television. So everything is interconnected. Well, this person, and greatly respect him, he was pushing. He wasn't just looking. He was pushing for the information to be, I don't want to say declassified, but published or at least researched, because he had a few of his own sightings. He was a very seasoned explorer of the Arctic. And back in 1950s, but also we mentioned it in the book, Stalin had a comprehensive program of Arctic research and put a tremendous amount of money and a few facilities in the area. He was concerned about something, and definitely would not be the Americans that time in the Arctic, something more. And then in the 1970s, the Soviet government put a lot of money in the Arctic, also created facilities, but for some reason, it's like laying eggs. They laid eggs waiting for something to come out, because they'd never used those facilities. They mothballed them, right? They would not do anything, but they put a tremendous amount of money. And now Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, seems to be opening those facilities and building more. And you need to understand that there is not that great interest among the Russians to live in the cold Arctic territories if there is no incentive.
Yes.
It was a little bit different in the Soviet Union, because they paid more money for you to go and work in the Arctic or Siberia, certain areas. And that's why people went to. Today it's different. They're leaving. And so Putin wants to make sure they do not. And at the same time, he says, well, we have this tremendous amount of natural resources, and the Americans and others want to put their hands on them. So he is building up Arctic territories. But, you know, and things are happening there. So what I want to say is that it's not, based on my research, it's not because they have Americans. It's not because of the Canadians. It's because there is something else that they all realize is happening down below. We still do not know why that specialized advanced Russian submarine perished almost a year ago with all crew and top scientists. Do you understand that even during the World War II, they never lost so many top naval personnel as they did not that long ago in the Barents Sea?
Yeah.
Why did they go down? Just to cut cable, a NATO cable? You don't need to put up Navy specialists to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's the people that were involved in that particular mission, Paul, suggest that there was a lot more to it than that, because at the end of the day, and I don't mean this disrespectfully to anybody in regards to that, you don't need that level of expertise and knowledge on such a simple mission, do you not?
No, you do not. And that's just the mission that we know about. Mm. But, you know, I was glad that we could uncover and put in the book some of the missions that nobody talks about. For example, when a Soviet scientific ship, and, you know, this phrase science, it was always usually spy ship, because they would use scientific vessels for other purposes. In the waters of South America, they were trying to bring up equipment that they put, deep down below, to scientific equipment to study flora and fauna. And they found out that somebody cut off their steel cables. It wasn't the only incident in the history of Soviet scientific research, but nobody knew why. What capabilities, beings down below have to cut off very thick steel cables? I mean, dolphins wouldn't do it, or assorted fish. So something is going on down below. And you know, again, it's all interchangeable. I often bring forward a report from, I believe, in the late 1970s by the head of the counterintelligence of the Pacific Fleet, Domyslovsky. Mm. He reported that in certain areas of the remote Pacific Ocean, Soviet ships would encounter a gigantic object in the sky. I think it was like a cigar-shaped object that would separate into smaller objects that would fly out, dive underwater, resurface, and do their research, and later leave. Of course, the Soviets, it was a gigantic object. They couldn't do anything. They were not going to shoot at it, because back in 1953, almost an identical object was sighted over Siberia, and this was just after Stalin died, and it exerted very detrimental biophysical effects or impact on the population down below, whoever was there. It was deep in Siberia. And exactly the same description, which we bring in our books, eerie. It was observed by a very capable scientist. Anyway, you have these objects, it's not only in Russia. Our focus was on the Russian and then Soviet reports of unusual submersible object or UFOs over the sea. But I'm sure that the American Navy has very interesting cases. I just don't know if they will ever come out, but at least we did an effort to bring Russian cases.
Yeah. I think one of the most intriguing sections of the book, and especially because there are a couple of photos in particular aspect to this case, Paul, is the incidents that seem to be occurring around South Georgia in the Atlantic. Now, that seems very unusual, because a lot of the people that are seeing things emerge from the sea or be above the sea, they seem to resemble mushrooms or mushroom shapes.
Yes. And so you start thinking, if some of them resemble mushrooms and the other ones resemble gigantic triangles, if there are not different forces at play on our planet. But that's a different discussion. We'll get to it, because, some are detrimental, some are very kind and beneficial to mankind, to humanity. I think that my readers in the United Kingdom should ask their elected representatives, what's going on in South Georgia?
Yes.
Here are photos and examples and reports by various types of Soviet ships, spy ships, submarines, fishing ships, and so forth. It's not too far away from the Antarctic. On more than one occasion, they had observed strange objects over the island. and it's a completely British territory. So what's going on? It couldn't be that British scientists would not have seen anything like that. So what is the level of secrecy? And this is not a joke. I mean, the Antarctic area itself is tremendously important. And I, in my YouTube channel, I try to bring cases, even about Lake Vostok and other instances, but even outside of Lake Vostok, there is something that's going on there. And of course, all the major governments are interested and have stations. China is extremely interested in the Antarctic and spends a lot of money to study it. And of course, the Soviet Union as well. But you see, they have been doing this hand in hand with the Americans. And this is very interesting because, you know, I found out that Soviet ships had been present in the area from 1946. Of course, under the guise of whaling ships, and through the great help of Argentina and Peron, they were able to use Argentinian harbors and then get to the Antarctica. And this is where they met with the Americans, with the Admiral Byrd expedition. I won't go into the American aspects, but I gotta tell you something, that the Soviet submarines were attacked by someone, and they were damaged in the 1940s by Antarctica. And then there is more. You know, we in the book we brought a number of cases about Antarctica as well, but it's an ongoing story. I remember reading a report which was not available for some reason in the West about a sighting made by Australian Navy, I think in the 1970s, of an unusual structures in the western Antarctica, down below, below the sea level, and it was fascinating. But I tried to get confirmation from the western sources, and I couldn't find it anywhere. See, in Russia, in modern Russia today, they published some. A number of things that now you don't, just don't hear in the West. And it's not, I don't think it's fake news completely, to the extent that they want to test out what is it that, what will be the reaction in the West to their publications. I've seen it. And it's very interesting. We're getting bits of information. This is one area. I want to bring attention to your listeners also to the ongoing story of the place few people even read about, Marianas Trench,
yes,
in the Pacific by Guam. Well, you know, it's incredible what the extent of the efforts of the Chinese and the Russians and the Americans and the Japanese to get down below and to study, because they know something is going on. And it was Soviet and American ships that aboard those ships you had scientists from both countries during the darkest days of Cold War. They work hand in hand to find out what's going on down below. You understand that the life down there doesn't belong on our sun. It's a completely different geochemical processes. It's a thriving life, and you should look at the worm tubes and other things that are found down below. And we're not giving all the information, of course. It's not being declassified, but we know enough. Even from 1963, descent of the Swiss and the American military men down below on the Bataskaf and what they had seen, and for many decades nobody else went down, but there was research, and this research is being intensified, and it's down below. Now that's Guam, Pacific Trench area. Yeah, it's very interesting. And it's not too far away from the hot zones like the South China Sea and other areas of potential conflict. But you know what? We speak about conflicts, and all of a sudden sometimes you hear, well, the United States Navy and the Chinese Navy had joint military war games. Or you hear the same about the Russian Navy and the Chinese Navy. And you start thinking, with all this animosity and competition, they're working hand in hand in many cases.
Yes.
It's not being advertised too much,
It is. I mean, it is interesting that there seems to be two levels to this. There seems to be the standard level of propaganda and nationalism, Paul, that affects all of us, regardless of which country we come from. And yet there are clearly collaborative missions in a variety of fields that seem to be going on with high-level sign-off. So we're clearly not being told everything, because if there is this level of animosity, surely it would affect all aspects of relationships, not just military.
No, you're absolutely right. And I've seen, I made my way to the West still as a teenager, but I wanted to continue to continue my research, and also I wanted to bring freedom to my country. So I was involved in smuggling books, doing a few other things just to bring freedom to the Soviet Union, to the people, because the potential was great. And I was always involved into this. And then, time goes by. All of a sudden, you see, mid-1970s, the détente policy. It was a great policy, so to say, because it would bring us, Andrei Sakharov used to say, our great scientist and dissident, it would bring convergence. Maybe the two systems somehow would form a new system, working together, peace, and this and that. And then it stopped with the very unusual invasion of Afghanistan, because still nobody knows why it happened. But it destroyed efforts to get together. And time goes by, and then the efforts continue again. Then you have the push to bring Gorbachev forward. Andropov was the one that helped bring Gorbachev, not the other pretendant who was a Stalinist. Anyway, Gorbachev wins, and then we have joint efforts again, like the space mission to Martian moon Phobos, and in many other areas. But this was on the mid-level. On the highest levels, based on very interesting statements of Soviet UFO researchers who were close to, let's say, government people in the Soviet Union, somehow got information. There has been a joint Western and Soviet UFO research, or I should say center to react to events, since mid-1950s, probably from 1956, after Stalin passed away and the Soviet Union went through a very unstable period of changes in the government, Khrushchev came about, and then I think this is when they started working together. I am not even sure about the Cuba crisis anymore. What really was happening, and why did they have to show to somebody that nuclear weapons could be used under a specific scenario? Because, it's very complicated. And then in the book, when you start reading about the effects of USOs on the Soviet Navy, how they disarmed a ship. This was in 1988, by the way. A whole ship, and this also was in the Far East of the Soviet Union. USO appeared, and it rose up from the waters, and then the whole ship, Novorossiysk, was disabled for some time. I mean, that's another demonstration of the tremendous power of whatever we're dealing with. And Pavel Popovich wanted to point out specifically one area. He has several areas in the Indian Ocean. Very interesting, because from the research available to me by Soviet submarine commanders such as Litvinov, whom I mentioned in the book, people who had studied thousands of cases, and some of them Soviet cases as well, they kind of figured out that most active areas of USO activity is in the North Atlantic, some in the Pacific, but the Indian Ocean as such is not very well researched or visited by USOs. But Pavel Popovich reveals that there was a base in the Indian Ocean. So this is something to think about.
Yes, I mean, Litvinov is a very interesting character, because from reading your book, Paul, it seems that he was tasked with this collection of reports, And I think he was surprised because he was a very balanced investigator, because he would, I think he states at one point in your book that of the reports he's received, 70% are natural phenomenon, misidentification, easily explainable. But that, as he says, still leaves 30% of the reports he's received, you know, mostly from military personnel, that are anomalous phenomenon of a variety of shapes and situations.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I have greatest respect for him. He on his own, conducted a lot of research, but he was well connected. And, you know, if you have connections, you don't get punished as much too. Sometimes when you get into something you shouldn't ask. But you know what? He was very, how can I say? I would say let's say 90% of the cases cannot be explained, or 95. I think that's what the Soviet Academy of Sciences says. But the 5% remain, and
yes,
no matter how much you cut away or try to explain, the cases still remain, and no one knows what we are dealing with. But definitely, it makes military commanders sleepless, and I'm sure those at the top, presidents and dictators and so forth at the very top, they want to look at China. China is a silent giant, so to say, but they are doing tremendous research in all aspects, in the space exploration and in the underwater exploration. They're going to build a facility, a gigantic facility, a city down below.
Yeah,
I believe it's in the South China Sea. Mm-hmm. But they're also active in Mariana Trench. Look at the submersibles they're building nonstop. And this will impact us. I remember giving a lecture in Hong Kong in 2012, and the interest, I've never seen so much interest from the audience, taking notes and so forth. You know, they're very serious people.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting situation when it comes to aspects like this, when you talk about China, Paul, because I think for the vast, even in Russia as a neighbouring country and a neighbouring territory, there's still a lot that we don't understand on a variety of fields. I mean, even in the world of cryptozoology, their study of the Yeren seems to be more scientifically based than anything done in the West in regards to Bigfoot or the Yowie or anything like that, Paul. So I would presume that their interest and their investigation of USOs and UFOs is probably being done at a higher academical level than any of us are aware.
Yes, and in Russia, nowadays you have very capable young military scientists which are involved with the space, Russian space forces and space research, and at the same time they study other phenomena, and it's very secretive, and I would say much more than in the Soviet times, and they have more capabilities to do so. Also in China, I try to bring information about China in my YouTube channel, but using Russian information, because they're very much interested in China as well.
Yes.
And they should be, but China is expanding worldwide, and I understand now they're making presence in the Caribbean Sea, which I don't think the United States is happy about. I just read about it, but oh yeah, they're not stupid. Look, I'm an independent researcher. I have I don't have a lot of means to do what I do, but I try. And twice in my life, I was able to do research in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, based on Soviet observations. For example, like those submariners who went to the Bermuda Sea, and you can read what they found in my book, but I'm sure they went beyond that, because they found out and reported secret reports, but leaked out, about ancient paved structures, roads leading from the Yucatan Peninsula into the sea. And I wanted to find out more, and I spoke to local people and so forth, but I found interesting things, and you see today discoveries in Yucatan. I think there'll be more. But China, as a country has many more capabilities than myself, as a, and so they expand, they go everywhere. Their UFO and USO research is quite different, just based on my observations and my reading. They support UFO research throughout the country, and I think there are tens of thousands of people who actually study this phenomenon, and they're being well funded, and it's a scientific aspect. Nobody makes fun of them. You know, the government is very much keen on finding out, and they are. You know, I'm sure they are finding out, because all of a sudden I see aspects of their space program that are very interesting. They're going to land on an asteroid. Asteroids reported to house so-called alien, I don't like this word, but that's what it is, alien observation stations.
Yes.
You know.
It is remarkable. And I think it will only progress, Paul, and I'm sure that the future is an exciting time for us, especially as space exploration seems to be reaching a level that we've not seen since the 50s and 60s. There's one aspect I'd like to touch on before you go, if that's all right, Paul. And obviously, we've discussed incidents in the seas and the oceans of the world. But obviously, Russia is known for having some of... I mean, Lake Baikal is the largest freshwater lake in the world. It's enormous. I was very interested to read some of the reports about some of the inland lakes and seas in the Russian area, especially, you know, like I say, Lake Baikal, and also some incidents in the Black Sea.
Absolutely. Lake Baikal, the most interesting aspect is not ever-present UFOs. Trust me, it's an unusual lake with unusual phenomena. But it's the presence of the so-called swimmers.
Yes.
And you will see it is the humanoid gigantic beings about 9 feet tall, which can operate at the bottom of our lakes and seas also without any breathing apparatus, and they don't like to be interfered with. And everything else you will find in the book. But I want to bring your attention to the so-called underwater humanoids and, you know, their basis of operations. As far for the Black Sea, one of the most interesting cases is the so-called a circular, if you can call it, a wheel-like UFO, USO, that was observed by Soviet scientists, I think back in late 1960s, in the Black Sea. It was standing vertically. It was like a 10-story building in size. After a while, it changed its shape and just, you know, it swirled around and disappeared. But that's a very unusual description of a USO. You also had in 1951, an object that was trying to break into the Soviet Union, you know, well below the surface, and the Soviets tried to stop it. They would drop bombs on it and so forth, because it was during Stalin's times. Americans did not have any similar ships or anything like that, or anybody else. So Black Sea has other cases too, and one of them is a more recent one that the Ukrainian observer was able to see, and I think there is even a photo that we present in the book about this. So nothing is past, it continues, and I think the more capabilities we have to observe what's going on down below through our satellites and other means, the more we'll be amazed.
Absolutely. I have to say, the bit in the book where there's one witness who describes his encounter with these strange swimmers is the one where it seems to wave at him, Paul, which I found, he had a very negative reaction, as you would expect. He had a very negative response to that encounter.
Yes. Well, and that shows you that if you, in some instances, UFOs, USOs, or creatures like that, if we do not interfere, we do not get burned or hurt. If we do interfere, yes, we suffer loss of aircraft. This happened in the Soviet Union on a number of cases. And so there was even an order in the Soviet armed forces which was disseminated and said, you know, do not attack.
Yeah.
Or in the case with this gigantic swimmers, armed forces personnel were dispatched, high-level personnel were dispatched to other deep-water lakes like Issyk-Kul, and the local commanders Mars were told not to interfere with any similar creatures operating at the bottom of the lake. Obviously, they knew more than we do. But there is no more Soviet Union in, let's say, time goes by, and still the Russian counterintelligence is very much interested in the presence of similar beings in the Far East, and we present that case as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a fantastic book, Paul. Thank you for giving us an insight into it, and I highly recommend it. I know it's available now. So, Paul, where can everybody keep up to date with your work and find your YouTube channel, sir?
Thank you for asking. Very easy. Just do this search in YouTube, Paranormal Phenomena Paul Stonehill. And you will get to it, and you will see some of the most latest cases, including the Dyatlov Pass, including Central Asia, China, Russian cases.
Yeah, it is fantastic. It's a channel I followed for quite a while, Paul, and there's always interesting articles, and it's a really good way to have a look at a topic that perhaps we don't know enough about here in the West. So thank you, as always, for bringing it to our attention, and thank you for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Paul.
From the Los Angeles Times, 20th of November, 1991. Winds of Glasnost that have scattered Soviet secrets, from KGB management skills to the final blame for Chernobyl, are airing another classified operation, UFO research sightings. For 25 years now, there have been secret studies by the Ministry of Defense, says Marina Popovich, a former test pilot with a doctorate in flight technology from the University of Leningrad, who, almost overnight, has become lead spokesperson for extraterrestrial happenings over Eastern Europe. The officials are beginning to open up the archives, but very slowly, she says. Full and final release, she believes, will be a long time coming in a nation addressing the more pressing priorities of dealing with breadlines and civil war. We think the reports will confirm about 14,000 contacts and UFO sightings over the past 25 years, says Popovich. She was in Los Angeles to speak at this week's Whole Life Expo. Before Glasnost, she says, UFO watching was neither safe nor easy in the Soviet Union. We had been researching UFOs for 25 years and talking about it in small groups, but we were underground. People who tried to talk about it in public were either fired or put in psychiatric hospitals. But now, in just 2 years, a Moscow magazine titled Inward Path has become a 50,000 reader forum for yogis, psychics, faith healers, ufologists, and other bearers of formerly taboo news. Most importantly, the monthly is printed on the presses of Pravda, the official government newspaper. Such outing has brought absolute freedom of speech for Popovich and her army of tens of thousands of scientists, academics and lay volunteers devoted to close encounters of any kind. They, like her, believe there are too many sightings, too many unexplained visitations to not believe in an extraterrestrial intelligence struggling to communicate with our planet. The argument that such highly sophisticated ETs should have little difficulty making direct and unmistakable communication with us primitive earthlings does not wash with Popovich. The bottom line of these multiple contacts is, we are not going to give you our technological information until you raise your spiritual and moral beliefs on Earth, she says. And the only way to raise them up is with unity, as one Earth together, to reducing negative feelings, pollution, and other detrimental-based energies. As a former Air Force colonel, she came within two finals of graduating from cosmonaut school. She was dropped, she says, after cosmonaut Pavel Popovich, the general she married, convinced officials that a woman's place was anywhere but in a space capsule. Previously, Marina was a test pilot, living in Star City and flying the full Soviet aircraft inventory from AN-22 transports to the supersonic MiG-21s. She holds 90 flight records and has been billed as the Chuck Yeager of the Soviet Union. It was during those test flights that Popovich's attention went from the skies around her to the earth below. I saw rivers drying up, lakes dying, a whole ecological disaster, she remembers. We were ruining soil for its natural resources, building ozone holes, creating dams that spoilt the dynamics of Earth's rotation. Economic activities intended to benefit a nation and a continent, she realised, were actually ravaging the ecology. I knew we would have to call a higher intelligence to enlighten us, to guide us through this mess, she explains. So I started on a long personal journey of discovery. Popovich joined a safari in the mountain ranges of South Asia, tracking the Yeti, a creature that is fact to a scant few and myth to millions. She didn't get her Yeti. But one dark night, says Popovich, two giant hands grabbed hold of my daughter and tried to pull her out of her sleeping bag, though the daughter saw nothing. The next night, she claims, a ball of light appeared and three beams of light fell on the camp. It hovered for a while, zigzagging away at high speed over our valley. It wasn't an aircraft. It wasn't a helicopter. It was a UFO. It was also a sign, Popovich says, to devote her post-military career to studying airborne phenomena. In that work, she writes, lectures, and heads organization researching anomalous phenomena, proposing a series of television programs to contradict what she considers the UFO-busting propaganda of the PBS series Nova. Popovich does not believe that Twilight Zone experiences in the Soviet Union have been any more startling or detailed than events reported in the United States. Our grocery store tabloids accuse the Air Force of holding mummified remains of a space being found in New Mexico. The main Soviet rumour, says Popovich, is of extraterrestrial metals found at a saucer crash site near Minsk. We have the UFO Information Retrieval Center here in Phoenix, and Citizens Against UFO Secrecy in Alexandria. The Russians have the National Association of Ufology in Moscow, and the Soyuz UFO Center in St. Petersburg. Both nations, agrees Popovich, have stacks of photographs of glowing blobs said to be flying saucers. She wears an amethyst necklace that she says contains power to ward off evil spirits. But she also wears a NASA watch that only keeps her safe from being late. From her work, from her absolute faith, Popovich believes the Force is with her. Unfortunately, it hasn't carried through to her terrestrial life. She's divorced from her cosmonaut general and says their differences were out of this world. I had the guidance, she reasons. He didn't. Marina Popovich passed away on November 30th, 2017, aged 86.